Sorry for not ringing the bell. We just finished orientation and went right into this, so I didn't have a chance to run up and ring the bell. So I'm glad you all looked at the schedule and were able to show up. My name is Sam. I serve as Education and Program Lead, and I just want to introduce Dan Spencer. Dan's a professor of environmental studies and has taught at the University of Montana since 2002. Some of his areas of teaching and research interests including ecological ethics, ethical issues in ecological restoration and globalization, justice, and environmental issues in Latin America and Southeast Asia. He's born and raised in California and went to Minnesota and New York for schooling. And he is the author of Gaia. Ethics, Ecology, and the Erotic, published by Pilgrim Press in 1986. And most recently co-authored a book with Flora Stivers and Jim Martin Shrum of Earth Ethics. Available through Orbis Press. And today he is talking to us about Earth Ethics 4, Case 2, Moral Eating, Issues Around Meat, Factory Farming, and Local Food Production. So please give your attention to Dan.
I don't know if it's still there or not, but somebody said they saw it there. So welcome everybody again, and I will begin again by questioning your sanity. It's such a beautiful day here. I don't know why we're all inside at this point, but we'll use this as a point of talk to each other. And we're good. I'm going to continue to use the mic here. My voice is coming back, but still a little raspy on this here. Quick survey, how many folks is this your first class in this Earth Ethics series? A lot. That's great. Well, welcome. That helps me because I want to figure out how to orient this to a few things here. Some people were asking me a question about hope, and that also came up in Alan's classes there. So I'm going to start and end the session with a couple of different thoughts about that from two of my favorite writers who I think offer some helpful things. So we'll start with one of them, which I hope will be helpful for you. Wendell Berry is one of my very favorite authors, and I think this is so appropriate for spending time at Holden here. I've used this many times in my annual Christmas letter. He says, "When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free." So I'll just offer that as an opening for us here. I'll remind you of a couple of things I've said earlier here. The topics around Earth Ethics are challenging ones because there's such an urgency in our world today about many of the issues that we're confronted with. So yesterday we looked at the intersection of decisions around population, human population, consumption, and climate change. And fortunately, the fire alarms shut us off right before about the climate change, so we didn't have to deal with that overwhelming topic, but I'll try and talk more a little bit about that today. And part of what we were doing yesterday was looking at the intersection between the personal decisions we make that affect these issues, but the much broader, larger, complex policy and structural issues. And we're going to see the same things going on today here on issues around food. Now, the part where I was asking who has been here before, I introduced on Monday and Tuesday three broad framing questions, and I'll just go through them quickly again because we're going to see they're really going to come up in the case today, but I want to focus more on the case itself. Environmental ethicists ask a series of questions to help orient ourselves to the kind of issues that are coming up around social justice and ecology, environmental issues. One of them is this debate between anthropocentrism and biocentrism. Anthropocentrism means human-centered, anthropo, human-centered, biocentrism, life-centered. The basic question here is who or what should be included in our moral community? And by a moral community, I mean who or what has moral status for their own sake, intrinsic value for their own sake, and that in turn makes claims on us. we need to respect those claims. And so as I talked about before, there's been a long, centuries-long struggle in the human race, so you keep expanding that from family to clan to region to nation state, and now we've reached the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that all human beings have moral status as human beings, and therefore they have rights that have to be respected. Many people are now raising the question whether that is too narrow. Do we need to expand it further to include other forms of life? And as we talked about before, many of us do this without necessarily thinking about it either. Now, if you have a companion animal, a dog, a cat, a horse, a sheep, whatever, for whom you care and you feel like you have some responsibility to the well-being of that, that animal sometimes is making a claim on you and you respond to its status that way. So there's the far side of this biocentrism is a society that says all forms of life have equal intrinsic value. Most of us aren't there. Most of us are probably somewhere in between. Pure anthropocentrism says only human beings have moral status. Everything else is simply resources for our use. It doesn't mean we mistreat them. Like lots of resources, you want to treat them prudently, but it means they don't have moral status. They don't make claims on us. The second one, this is a long-standing debate in the Western tradition, but I think in almost any culture, is how do we balance the tension between a focus on individuals and individual rights and the whole well-being of the community. And so in the social realm, that has been a big debate between, for example, liberal democracies like ours, which have a strong emphasis on individual rights. We have a Bill of Rights in our Constitution to emphasize that. And then more socialist or communist countries that say, no, the primary moral concern is with the whole well-being of the community. And then you have societies in between, such as the social democracies like Scandinavia, that try to balance them somewhere in between. When you take that debate and put it in the environmental realm, it offers, do we focus on the individual well-being of animals and humans, or do we focus on the well-being of ecosystems and communities and there? And again, we talk about, in some cases, people feel this is a false dichotomy. We want to emphasize both of those. But there are times when things conflict, and we'll take a look at some about them, and we have to make choices and give reasons for that. And then the third discussion we've been talking about is, what's our vision for where we're going to address these issues here? And this I put in sort of three positions. One is status quo. This simply says, our current situation is sufficient to deal with the issues that come up. We don't need to change it at all. Right? In fact, oftentimes in this one, people will argue that we have too much regulation. We're over-regulating the environment. We need to let the free market operate more freely, free of regulation. Then there's kind of a middle position that says, we have a system that we need is sufficient, but we need to reform it. We need better laws, we might need to update our economic theories, better technology, so we can reform our system, and that's sufficient to address these range of issues that we have. And then there's another group of folks who simply says, no, our system and our culture behind it is the problem. It has produced an unsustainable way of living, and until we really transform that, we're only playing with symptoms. We need to really get to the root causes of that. And we'll see some of that debate reflected in the issues today around food that I want to play a little bit here. But let me just pause at this point and see, for those of you who are new, this is a relatively quick overview. We spent a fair amount of time on these issues on Monday and Tuesday. But they'll come up again in the debate here. So let me just see if there's any questions or things I can clarify, or if people who've been here have any further insights on this. Okay, then I'm going to start with the ethics test that I always give to my students. How many of you read the homework? A lot of you. Okay, that's good. How many of you have a copy of the case with you? Good. Okay, there may not be a much if you had to share a few here, because I do want to start like we did yesterday, but I'll give you an overview of the case, but then we're going to have a little discussion up here, and I want to break you up into sectors on that. Now, this case, I put up here a couple of my favorite quotes from Michael Pollan. Some of you may know his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He makes a claim, he says, eating is an ecological and political act. So let's unpack that for a moment. What in the world might he mean by eating is an ecological and a political act? First, how would it be an ecological act?
Meat or vegetables.
Yeah, how's that an ecological act?
Effect on the environment.
Is that?
Effect on the environment.
Effect on the environment. One of the things we recognize is, and I always make this to my students here, eating is not an option to forego if you are an animal. If you're an organism of any kind, we only survive by eating. And we, like all other organisms, exist within ecosystems. So what we eat and what we exclude as waste products always have ecological impacts. So eating, by its very definition, whatever organism, affects its ecosystem. In a balanced or healthy ecosystem, one organism's food or one organism's waste product becomes another organism's food, so they balance each other out. Part of the problem that we have increasingly is we produce too much waste. The system can't absorb it well. We'll see that how that comes up here, for example, with concentrated animal feed operations or factory farms. We produce so much animal waste that it becomes really poisonous in the environment, or the waste we're producing is toxic. It has all sorts of chemicals in it, like we see across Railroad Creek here, or it's nuclear waste, things like that. So we are not finding a way to have our waste products be sustained. But similarly, oftentimes the amount and way we eat is unsustainable. So we overfish the oceans. We overfarm areas and the soil becomes sterile. But all these are ecological implications. Now, how about the second one? Eating is a political act. What might that mean? Back here, Rita.
I suppose if we all start eating quinoa and the people of Peru exist on quinoa and they have to have a cash crop now.
That's a really interesting example. The people here are saying, if we all start eating quinoa, what would be the implications of the people of Peru? I'm aware of this in January in Montana. We have a wonderful food system in our university. The food service there is really great. And in January, we have this beautiful salad bar. And you can just get every imaginable green thing, red thing, fresh vegetables and all that. And none of it's grown in Montana in January. Right? In fact, a lot of it's not even grown inside this country. It's grown in places like Guatemala, Nicaragua, other places that export it, which means it's growing food for export from those countries, and sometimes at the cost for them growing their own food. Right? So that's an oversimplified analysis, but our food systems always have social, political consequences. And the individual choices we make influence those systems there. So that's part of what we're going to look about. At one level, eating is one of the most intimate acts that any of us do. And in our biblical tradition, so much of it is built around shared meals and shared food and hospitality, so the recognition of food and dietary laws. But increasingly in our world, we are distanced from how food is raised, how it's processed, how it's transported. And what we're going to see today, we're going to look at some of the issue about animals here. For many of us, the primary interaction we have with animals today, we're no longer an agrarian society, we're no longer a hunter-gatherer society, so the primary interaction many of us have with animals is on our plates, unless we have a companion animal. So what are the implications about that? Now, Michael Pollan also has this other thing here. He says, the wonderful thing about food is you get three votes a day. Every one of them has the potential to change the world. So how many of you ever think about the food options available here at Holden?
Ask that
question. How many of you think about the food options available at Holden here? In Holden makes a very intentional, thoughtful thing about the kind of food. Holden is very aware that virtually all of the food that we eat has to be brought in, has to be prepared here, and waste products have to be dealt with either composting, landfilling, or sending waste products downwind. And so Holden has a very intentional food philosophy, and when we eat at Holden, we're voting into those kind of decision-making choices like that. So we'll look at that a little bit as well here. So let me give you an example, an overview of the case itself. I'll talk about what we're going to do. The case is centered on a young man named Peter who grew up in Des Moines, Iowa, and now has gone to the University of Montana. And he is at the University of Montana. And while he was in Iowa, as a part of a high school project, he began to research what some people know as factory farming, more technically called concentrated animal feed operations. But that increasingly, animals raised for consumption in our food system are raised in very, very highly concentrated, large number, highly confined operations there. And this is true of hens for both, or hens for egg laying, chickens for meat, cattle for production, hogs for production, so forth and that. So Peter's become very concerned about the ethical issues about how we treat animals. At the same time, he's aware, living in Iowa, that Iowa in the last 30 years or so has gone through a fundamental change in agriculture from a state of lots of small family farms that supported rural communities to a state that's largely corporate agriculture. And so if you spend time in Iowa, about 80% of Iowa is covered in one of two crops, either corn or soybeans. And these are largely agro-industrial scale kind of things. So Peter has become interested in thinking about alternatives to the agro-industrial scale things as we get sustainable food and farming. He's gone to the University of Montana to do that. He became a vegetarian while he was growing up in Iowa because of his concerns about how animals were treated and also about the environmental impacts of a meat-based diet. Much to his surprise, when he lands in Montana, he finds a lot of committed environmentalists who are not vegetarian, who explicitly incorporate animals into the kind of agriculture there. What's more, he finds a lot of environmentalists who are hunters, who see hunting animals as part of sustainable ways of interacting with the environment. So this raises a whole series of questions for him, how to deal with these things here. And Peter lists four main areas for why he became a vegetarian. That's what I want to just quickly go over with you here, Deb. And we'll be looking at these here. He says one is he's become aware of the environmental consequences of meat-based diets that create particularly the amount of water and the amount of grain that's needed to raise animals for meat, for consuming them, far, far exceeds the amount of water and energy you need for a vegetarian or grain-based diet. So there's a lot of, in particular, we'll start looking at the impacts of this on climate change. Secondly, he's very concerned about social justice concerns about meat-based diets. One of the things he learns, for example, is the amount of grain that is fed to animals just in the United States for consumption would feed all of the hungry people in the world, about 840 million people. So that if we simply took the grain that goes to an animal-based diet in one country alone, the United States, that would be sufficient to provide a nutritious diet for people who are hungry in the world. So he's concerned about the social justice dimensions around a meat-based diet or an animal-based diet. Third, he's recently asked questions about the health issues with industrial meat. One of the realities is when you confine tens of thousands of animals in very small spaces, they breed disease. They become very bad. So over 50% of all the antibiotics that are used in the United States are now used not on humans, but on animals. Similar kind of things, 30% of all pesticides are used in crops to feed animals. And so he's really concerned about what's happening to our food around where because of the industrial scale context for that. And then fourthly is the one that he started with in the first place, is what does it mean to take animals who are sentient? That means their capacity to feel suffering and pain and to treat them in these kind of conditions simply for our benefit when it's not necessary for our diet. And so those are the four issues that have motivated him, but now he's found himself complicated by considering other perspectives. And what I'd like to do, I'm gonna have you talk for about 10 minutes, groups, and I'll divide you up again, sort of like we did yesterday, that Peter encounters five different folks who make him stop to think about how to frame these issues here. First of all, his childhood friend Roger has a father named Jack, who's an agronomist with the Cargill Corporation, and I have the page numbers on here so you can refer to them. And Jack argues that we really need agrotechnology for food security, to raise enough food to feed people in a hungry planet there. So he argues in favor of our current agricultural industrial scale system. Then his friend Shannon, who's kind of unnamed in the case, but I'm calling her Shannon, Casey there, is a student from a UM group called University of Montana Climate Action Now that's very concerned about the consequences for climate change around meat-based diets on that and makes her arguments in there. But he has a friend named Courtney who grew up on a ranch outside of Missoula in a valley called the Blackfoot Valley. And she's a fourth generation rancher, and they do what they call conservation ranching, grass-fed beef. They ranch in such a way that they share the ranch with wildlife habitat, accommodate that. So they argue in favor of local beef production as a healthy economic and dietary thing. Then his mentor at the University of Montana is a man named Nate, who's the director of the university's farm. The university has a 10-acre farm where a lot of students do internships and so forth. It's primarily a vegetable farm, but they've also integrated hogs and chicken into that farm there, which has created a lot of controversy with some of the farm founders who supported the farm when it was only a vegetarian farm and now feel betrayed because they've incorporated animals into it. Right? So this kind of thing, but Nate is a big advocate of the local food system, what we call localization of the food system. And then final one is food friend Carmen, who is the director of the Student Animal Legal Defense Fund, and she comes from a strong animal rights, animal defense position, and simply argues because we have alternatives to meat-based diets, it's unethical to eat any animals. It's unethical to treat animals as a means to an end. We should be treating them as ends in their own right on that, from that perspective. So these are the five perspectives that Peter's confronted with. And what I'd like to do is I'm gonna divide you up into five groups here. And those of you who are in the balcony, if you wanna come down and join us, you're welcome to. If you wanna sit out, that's fine too. I'm gonna give you about 10 minutes. I'd like you to make sure we have a few of the copies of the case in there. I'd like you to review the positions of each of these characters in there and familiarize yourself with them enough that you can name a spokesperson for your group, but somebody who can really advocate for that position. And we'll come up here, and I'm going to have you each try to convince me that your position is the most ethical one and give me the reasons why. We'll also have you engage each other and engage people in the audience there. Do that for a while to kind of flesh these positions out. Then, like we did yesterday, we'll back off and begin to examine these positions and think about where we place ourselves in that. All right? So, let's take. I have the folks back in the corner there. If you would be Jack, the agronomist from Cardinal, and his position is outlined particularly on page 100. If we can get some of the folks up more in the front here, maybe some of you here. If you would be Shannon, the student from UM Climate Action Now, she talks about her positions on 102 there. If we can get the folks kind of in the middle clustering here to be Joel, the rancher in the Blackfoot Challenge, advocate for conservation ranching on that. If we can get the folks more in the front of this area here to be Nate, you're the director of the university farm. He argues, Phillips has arguments on page 104. And if we can get the folks in the corner, you're going to be the ecofeminist, the Carmen, the animal legal defense folks in that, arguing against eating any animals. So I'd like you to go for about 10 minutes, both review the position, but talk to each other about it to raise your own questions, see if you can clarify that position. Find one person who's going to be the initial spokesperson here, and then we're going to go. If you're having trouble understanding your position, I'll turn my mic off and Phil can call me over, and I'm happy to discuss with you about it. All right? Do we have enough copies? Is there any group that doesn't have some? Yeah. I want to start by saying I'm really appreciative of people being willing, that my friends coming here to help me. You know, since I moved to Iowa, I thought I was so clear about my own diet and what we call planet eating stuff here. And being in Montana really has kind of confused me. I think it's a more complex issue than I was aware of. I was really glad that my friend Roger's dad, Jack, was willing to come out to Montana and engage in this conversation with us here. And Jack, you and I have had a lot of conversations over the years. You work at Cargill. I still have a lot of questions about what you're doing, but I know you're particularly concerned with food security issues, so I'm wondering if you could talk about why you think the current agricultural system is what's needed to address these issues of concern of food and animals.
Well, we see our food production in three different ways. One is conservation, one is efficiency, and one is supply. In Iowa, we are very particular about disease. And as we know, that disease can wipe out a whole nation's food supply. And so we like where our corporate farms and our corporate situation allows us to monitor disease, prevent disease, and to give a more stable price. Of course, our corporation provides farmers with a place to sell their food, their crops. They have a guaranteed purchase. When they plant their crop, they know they're going to get the money for it. So it really is brings a stability to the state, along with the food supply for the nation and around the world. The ideas are The idea is to produce as much as we can efficiently. And in this way, the cost of the food, it puts less burden on the economy and it can distribute around the world. We have water treatment plants. We try to keep up with the environment through filtration and through waste development. One thing too, a lot of our waste also turns into fertilizer, which is used around the country also. So it's a self-sustaining, and everything has a purpose in our industry.
Well, I'll say
it. I know one of the things that you always stressed to me was that the Americans pay the least amount of percentage of their paycheck on food than anybody in the world. That we, you talked about food security and relatively cheap food. I think the average American only spends about 10% of their income on food, which is far lower than any other place. But I wonder, is that happening because some of the costs are being externalized and simply not reflected in the price of that food?
I don't really think so that we're approach it in that manner. We are a business, and that's one of our main goals is to provide return on our investors in the safest way and the most economical way. The amount of money spent on food, I think since it is cheaper, they can spend less of their money on food and apply it to other places in the world and other things that they might need.
Thanks, Jack. I really appreciate that. Shannon, you opened my eyes into a whole other argument I didn't really think about growing up in Iowa, and that's the connection to our food systems to climate change, which, we're working out here at the University of Montana. A lot of emphasis on that. Could you just, how would you address what Jack is saying? How does this connect at all to climate change?
I guess I can put it pretty bluntly. If you're concerned about climate change, I don't think meat is an option at this point. Globally, livestock production is one of the leading causes of greenhouse gas emissions. Livestock produce 80 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions per year, and that's 23% of our annual greenhouse gas emissions. You just can't argue with that kind of figure. No matter how sustainable the production is in other ways, no matter how humanely raised the animals are, they're still emitting. And so I guess that's the bottom line.
I was really stunned to read that, because we hear so much about climate change in terms of driving automobiles and things like that, but that cattle actually produce far more greenhouse gases than automobile emissions do, which I was really kind of blew me away. But you also brought up something I just never thought about before, and that's concern with deforestation of our tropical rainforest in the Amazon. How in the world is that tied to meat-based diets?
Well, in order to have, in order to raise cattle and usually cattle in the Amazon, you have to have a lot of land. And much of our meat production now comes from places like the Amazon, other places in Latin America. And so in order to have that kind of, not even free range, in order to just raise these animals, you just need land. And it happens in the United States, but more and more it's happening across the world, so it's becoming a justice issue as well. And you're losing those carbon sinks across the world. So
what is a carbon sink?
So carbon sink is anything that holds carbon, that does not emit carbon. So that would be the rainforest. That would be where we are in Montana. I've heard Holden Village also has some trees around it.
Well, you reminded me that almost 20% of greenhouse gas emissions comes from deforestation worldwide. Again, a larger source than even our automobiles. So when we're cutting down the rainforest, so we have cheap hamburgers, that really raises emissions. But I want to turn next to my friend Joel over here. Joel, your daughter Courtney's become a really good friend of mine, and she has a really different experience of cattle production than what we've been talking about here in terms of me raising the Amazon. Seven Cheese argued that at least grass-fed beef in Montana is really a sustainable part of the solution, not a part of the problem. Could you just tell us a little bit about your ranching operation and how you see this fitting into our agriculture and food systems?
Well, yeah, we've been ranching for generations. It's been in our family for a long time. And a lot of people talk about animals and talk about meat and values. And you know, we look animals in the eye. We work with them all the time, and we understand how they live and how they work in the environment. But I'm also concerned about what happens to our lifestyle, our culture of ranching, because we're under pressure from a lot of development, all these millionaire Amazonians from Seattle, all kinds of millionaires buying up and subdividing the land. And we see what happens with the environment when that happens, because there's a lot of the wildlife that we see and we go out hunting all the time rely on vast stretches of land to survive. And by following the seasons and the animals, we know how ranching can coexist with the wildlife and actually help benefit it by providing the stuff that's naturally was done by bison mulching around on the grass, and we rotate animals from pasture to pasture to prevent overgrazing and erosion from that. And we source everything locally. The animals are all grass-fed, and so they're healthy. We can get a higher profit from selling the meat, but more, it's all contained within a system, and we're miles away from the whole family meat factory type of thing. This is all wholesome food, which is generated and consumed locally, and it provides good food for a lot of people in Montana.
So you introduced me to the whole notion of conservation ranching, that ranching can actually be a tool of conservation, which protects our ecosystems and things like that. But how do you deal with predators?
Well, predators are a problem. You have to make some adjustments in how you watch your cattle, and there are some challenges with wolves and increasingly with some bears, but there's also a little bit of a benefit from that, because there's also the deer population or the elk, which can also cause some issues in some areas. Some of the weaker animals are taking out. So you do have to make some adjustments in how you do the ranching, but overall we look at the whole environment and how that fits together, and we believe that ranching can coexist with wolves and bears.
Thank you, Nate. You're one of part of the main reason I came to the University of Montana was to study sustainable food and farming, but I have to admit I was a little surprised to find pigs and chickens at the farm here. And then I know that once the harvest is in the fall, you take a week off and go hunting every fall, which was just such a different kind of perspective than I had on environmentalists here. But you really opened my eyes to a lot about agroecology and local food systems. So I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit more about how you see that as addressing some of the issues that are brought up in the panelists.
Pete, you came to the right school. This is where you're gonna see how much of the rest of the world is. I've traveled around the world. I've worked in other places. I've seen how in villages and small communities, the kind of program we have here works in the real world. So what we have is a system where our animals, which are only a few animals, we don't have big operations. We have a few hogs, a few chickens, a few beef, and we follow them through their lives. We introduce them to our families. The kids get to know them. School kids even bring in stuff to feed them, the waste products. We have a chance to use their manure. They're just part of our cycle of life. And when it's time to butcher them for their meat, we do that, and we feel that they are then part of the food chain that we all enjoy. we don't see that our animals are not going to be in a big factory. They're going to see the blue sky. They're going to have green grass. There's an appreciation of the sort of this fullness of life. And I don't think you can get away from the fact that in our culture, in our economy, it's very difficult to be purely vegetarian. Meat is just going to be part of the diet that we eat. And I think this is the kind of a sustainable way that if many small communities around our country would follow, I think that we would see fewer of the problems that go along with the big agriculture.
Yeah, I have two questions for you, Reed. Jack raises the question of food security. Do you think really we can feed our country with a network of these small farms like this? Don't we need the industrial scale farming on that? And then I also wonder, are you just kind of a unintentionally propaganda wing for the animal industry because you bring children to the farm and show them this kind of common, but that's not how most meat gets to their plate. That's not how they're eating. I mean, most of the food that gets to plate, eggs and animals, went through the intensive agriculture system here. So how do you address concerns like that?
Well, I do admit that when the kids come to the farm, we have picture ops with them. They can put their you know, kind of hug the cow and, you know, and take that home. So, I mean, we get them to be attached to these animals. And what was I think I'm not worried about food security. We're not worried about the nation. We're worried about our community, and we just think all communities should take on this approach, and they will then take care of themselves. And it's not up to us in our small corner of the world to be providing food for the rest of the world.
So Carmen, you're one of the first people I met at the University of Montana. I was so excited to know that there was a Student Animal Legal Defense Fund here, and you become a very close friend. Your philosophy studies have given you a lot of grounding on it. And so it's kind of, I feel a little nervous telling you that I'm wavering on my own vegetarian commitments because of some of these other things. So how would you address these issues that have been brought up here?
Well, after listening to all of you, I'm a little shook up. Any of you have a dog? Nope. You have any animals?
Nope.
You just said you raised them on the farm.
I got two cattle, I got two hogs, and I got about six chickens.
Now give me their names.
So the cattle are Henry and George, and the hogs are Lewis and Phil. Yeah, the chickens, we really haven't named. They're just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
All right, do it for me one more time quickly.
George, Lewis, and Thelma, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
What color are their eyes?
The cat.
I can't hear you anymore. You know, I first came to this position when my neighbor came home and she was in third grade, and she announced to everybody she wasn't going to eat anything with her face. And at first, I thought that's a little goofy, because I like all kinds of things with faces. But you know, I've been moved to this because I saw a movie, Bambi. Right? And did you guys ever see Finding Nemo?
Yeah.
Do you remember Nemo?
Yeah.
Do you remember Dory? Do you remember Dory?
Yeah.
Do you care about Dory? Does anybody here eat fish? Monsters. We're talking about wholesale slaughter. I mean, you just disregard the life of another creature that's sentient, that has the ability to suffer and feel joy and pain, and feedlots that are created to generate food in protein forms for us is unconscionable. We don't need this. But look at how many people have fangs. Maybe you have fangs, I mean sharp ones. You would. We're mostly vegetarian, and we can live that way, and the world can sustain it. And it breaks my heart. It breaks my heart that you would eat our fellow creatures. I can't talk anymore.
Have you ever worked a hard day's work days in your life? Have you ever grown any food? Do you grow all your food? Everything you eat?
I can't talk to you right now.
If you ate meat, you could talk.
Well, I was wondering if anybody wanted to address anybody else on the panel, but I'm not sure if you're on the floor here. But Shannon, do you have any questions about have these other folks asked for you in terms of implications of meat-based diets for climate change?
I mean, I think I just go back to my main question, which is how are we going to solve the emissions problem? I just, any of this would be easier if we were just talking about plant production, just talking about growing plants. We can, as Carmen said, sustain a diet based on plants, and it would feed the entire world. Right now, we have that capacity. So I do wonder, we've all been talking about food security. What about plant production and the way that it can right now? All of this food that is feeding livestock just in the United States could be feeding the world. What are we doing about that?
And Jack, what are your thoughts about this?
We have a corporate and we have a responsibility in the world to feed the world, and we take that very seriously at Cargo. Not only do we do it in Iowa and several states, but we have programs where farmers from other states can come and view our factories and see how efficient you can raise beef, you can raise pigs, chickens. We do it in a very efficient manner and make as much food available that is for the world and for the country at an economical price. Now we also sponsor programs around the world, and a lot of our programs in third world countries involve the use of biogas. And so, since with our all experience with pigs and hogs, we are able to research this very well and do good around the world. And they can cook instead of burning wood and deforesting. They can cook with biogas. They can light their homes with biogas. And all of this research is available in Iowa at our factories. We have research scientists. And so we understand the concern for greenhouse gas. We understand the concern for agriculture. But the end is feeding, and without food, we would not be as powerful a nation, and our buying power would be reduced.
How do you respond to the charges that people like Carmen make that this is all dependent on massive animal suffering that is not necessary, but when you do it at industrial scale, it's unavoidable?
Well, we would believe in the chain of life, and we were put on this earth to have dominion over animals, and it's a commodity, it's a base, and we believe we do take more care in the way we slaughter than the old days, and we have research on that.
It's just a subtle reminder about our sacred cows or our sacred hogs. But anybody in the audience have any questions for any of the panel members here?
I want to talk about it. You did a great job, by the way, but this wasn't part of that discussion. You said you have family that is big time as far as doing the corporate type hog farming. And I, for 12 years, had a 2-acre farm, but it had a small hog operation on it. And the way I worked it is that we're bringing in 20 feeder pigs, and they had plenty of room. It was concrete, but they had plenty of room for an outside run and an inside run. And so I raised them to term, and I had a garden, 120 by 60. So all the manure fit in the garden, so there was nothing going and polluting the environment at all. And my goal was to have one for me and sell 19 to Hormel. Sometimes I made a profit, sometimes I didn't. But, and I also, hog operations and the big operations, he didn't tell you, they medicate all their feed because it keeps them healthy. But you're still having all your pork and things has medicated it. I didn't, because I'm so small, I didn't get diseases coming, things like that. So it's all free of these type of things. So it's very, very healthy type stuff. Our conclusion in our group and beyond is that I think is the consensus that what his operation isn't going to be sustainable as far as doing everything. But we need areas like what he's talking about, what Joel's talking about, and niches like that, but it can't do the whole thing. We have to do some reduction of meat. So I think that's good.
Right. I think you sound fairly close actually to Nate's position too about the small scale farming being really good. Anybody here want to make a last minute comment for it? Go ahead.
I don't think it's just the meat. I think it's also that our agricultural land is disappearing. If you look at the big cities, they are gobbling up land all around them that was once farmland. I know in Texas, we see that all over, and I'm sure that's happening in other states too. That's a major concern to me, and they're all the farms, small farms are disappearing. It's the large farmers, and they have to do that because that's the way you suspect
are given to animals right now in the process of raising them. And we're dealing, and we're not getting that many new antibiotics brought. The research isn't being done. In other words, we're not getting new antibiotics in any useful number today. And there's more antibiotic diseases, and there's a lot of people dying because antibiotics aren't touching some of these diseases now. And that problem is going to increase, and that's going to make a difference on all of this factory farming.
Thank you for that. I mean, we're really just scratching the surface right here about there are just many, many different issues. That once we work with an industrial scale agricultural system involving animals, brings those up. Is this still working okay?
Yes.
Let me just go through a few things here, just to give a sense about this here. I'm going to eventually go through this fairly quickly.
I like that.
We'll skip over those parts here. But what I wanted to do is see if we could place these characters where they would be on here, on this here. So, for example, Jack, who represents Cargill, where would you put him? And I thought, who was this person who represented Jack? And what's your name again?
Randy.
Randy, I thought did a fantastic job with this. Where would you put Jack on these first spectrum?
Anthropocentric.
Yeah, completely anthropocentric.
Status quo.
And animals are resources, but what we need to focus on human interests on that. So Jack would be stronger over there. What about the individualistic versus community focused and roles? This one's a little tougher in some ways here.
They would claim to be community focused.
But what is a market-based system most based on? Individual choice. Individual consumer choice, property rights, things like that. Strongly that you can say says those accomplish community goals, but it's strongly focused on each of us has the right to choose what we want for our diet. We can treat animals as property, things like that. And then where would it be in terms of status quo, reform the system, or transform the system?
Status quo.
I mean, the JAP represents the current status quo, which is the agro-industrial sector, and the arguments for efficiency, you did really well. Efficiency, technology, you know, those kinds of things. How about Joel, who's the rancher in the Blackwood Valley? Where would you put him in the middle one? More towards biocentrism, but which side do you think he's closer on as a rancher? Yeah, I mean, I think he clearly cares about his animals, but he's also a rancher. His animals are the needs of livelihood. And so we're still a problem on the end in there, but they're still an important product for him. What about the second one? It's a little harder to know sometimes from what we're talking about here.
Well, we can
be
in between, I think.
If you think about ranching culture in general, it tends to be strongly on the individual side, strongly to some property rights and things. But what do we also know about what Jack is, or Joel is doing? What is he participating in? He says it's the Blackfoot Challenge. It's a very community-based thing. He barely values ranching as a way of life, old culture. So he's got interesting interests on both sides of this. And then what would you put him in the order? Status quo, reform, transform? Probably reform, right? He's still very much working within a market economy, but he says there are things we can do within that to make it more environmentally sustainable. And then there. Then you got someone like Nate, right? Nate is the farm director of the university's farm. Where would you put him in the perspective there? More biocentric, but he's also still using animals as a means to an end there. He says he doesn't want anything to do with the active farms. He wants animals to be treated well, so there's respect for them. So he's somewhere along that area there. What about the individualist as opposed to community focused? Yeah, here and again, if we tease it out a little more, says that Nate, who's based on a friend of mine, strongly focused. In fact, what he says is, he says the main product of our university farm is community. He says the way we're trying to do agriculture, building a local food system again, is to involve the community and create community. So it's really strongly oriented in the holistic well-being. Dorothy?
Is he under any pressure to make profit?
Well, this is the interesting thing. It's you know, some people say it's unrealistic. That farm is run by a nonprofit group called Garden City Harvest. It's also part of the University of Montana. A lot of its labor is tuition-paying students. You know, so it's buffeted, though it's protected from there. It also, though, produces 36,000 pounds of food that goes to the food bank every day, year. Very community-oriented. So it's an interesting kind of question. Would this be a viable model in that area? Where would you see Nate on the bottom on status quo, reform, transform? Yeah, Nate is really involved in this whole movement to transform our food economy away from agro-industrial to a local food system. It's got to be on that. Now, I'm going to skip over Shannon for a moment here. Let's just talk about Carmen. Carmen is the animal legal defense person. Where would she be on the first one? Strongly biocentric. How about the second one? And this is an interesting one. Animal rights folks focus on the individual animal. The individual animal makes moral claims on it, so it should be strong, individualistic. How about the bottom one? Transform. If we were to take seriously no longer eating, testing, wearing, so forth animals, we would tell you a major transformation here. So when I work with my students, we map it out. It begins to look about like this. And this is pretty much what you've got. You notice Jack is way over here. And I've noticed, interestingly enough, Jack and Carmen are both strongly individualistic. Where they differ is Jack is strongly anthropocentric, only human rights matter. Carmen is strongly biocentric, animal rights matter. The other place they differ is Jack then very much in the status quo. Carmen is way over here. We need to transform the system on that. So you can, we spent some time here, and I've kind of put Peter in terms of where he came into the situation on that. Strongly biocentric, focusing on individual animals, and then kind of transformative. His initially is pretty close to Carmen's. He's been pulled over to this direction and over here now.
Yeah, shouldn't there be under individualistic and community focus? I think Nate was community focused, but he was real. You left out the global focus. There's another dimension to that that's missing.
That's a good point. Sometimes these end up being overly simplified on this. Yeah. You can see where we map Nate. We had Nate halfway between anthropocentrism, biocentrism. This is again, without, you know, people may differ, but that's what I think largely the biblical view is. I think the Genesis view sees individual, all of creation being good, having value, but humans being in a position where we talk about the dominion of stewardship. And Nate is determined to be a really good steward of these animals, but at the end of the day, he's still going to eat them. Okay? Now, Nate, you see, we mapped him strongly focused on the community thing, which would include the global as well as the local. And he's particularly interested in sustainable food systems. Now, he might differ a little bit. Is it Brian? Is that right? from Brian's representation, because Nate is convinced that we can feed the world through sustainable local food systems there. We don't need an agriculture industrial scale on that. And that's a really important debate on whether we can do that. And then Nate really is calling for a more transformation of what we're talking about here. So there's a lot of other stuff we have time to cover today. I promise, so what I would say is, if we were going to characterize quickly then, Jack represents a typical free market approach. Work within the market system, work for efficiency, return a profit to your stakeholders, so forth. Joel is a conservation approach. Cattle are still resources, but we should use them wisely and prudently. We should use the land wisely and prudently. Nate is moving into what we remember we did a couple days ago, we had the whole ecological dimension. Nate said we need to think and act ecologically. So he's talking about agroecology. We build our homes and model of many ecosystems. Carmen is stronger than animal rights, animal defense. Some would say it's ecofeminism. If we read her arguments more, she would make the connection between the way patriarchal societies have treated women as resources and use women's bodies as resources, and the way patriarchal societies use animals as resources. And there are the links between those mutual forms of oppression on that. And then Shannon raises a whole different issue about thinking global about climate change on that. So what we, and then Peter is still debating where he is on this. Now, just, I'm sorry, because I know there's a four conversation, so I want to end here. What we can do is go through each of these ones and really begin to unpack them. But I think it came out pretty well in the position here. I promised I would end instead with this question that also came up in Alan's one.
Thinking up till 5 till 4:15.
Do I have till 4:15? I know, I think there's two 4 o'clock sessions, aren't there?
Yeah.
I think I better end. I want to give you one graphic, though. This is a really fascinating graphic, which we oftentimes don't understand the trade-offs we're making. By having a meat-based diet, animal-based system here, we are essentially substituting the habitat that wild animals would have used to raise domestic animals. This just shows Earth's land animals by weight currently. So the center of that's human beings. This is cattle. This is sheep. This is goats. That's pigs. Here's the world's remaining elephants. These two color ones here are the remaining wild animals by weight, land animals. We're currently at about a 10-to-1 ratio. If you include human beings that are domestic animals, we outweigh a 10-to-1 ratio of all the remaining wild animals in there, because we have simply taken all their habitat and turned it into support for a meat-based diet. So when you begin to look at it this way here, you can see some consequences of that. I promise I will end with a question of hope.
Yes.
So we'll get past all that. This is Janice Ray. I quoted this last week here. Here's what she says, which I really like. The assumption is that hope is a prerequisite for action. Without hope, one becomes depressed and then unable to act. I want to stress that I do not act because I have hope. I act whether I have hope or not. It's useless to rely on hope as motivation to do what's necessary and just and right. Why doesn't anybody ever talk about love as motivation to act? I may not have a lot of hope, but I have plenty of love, which gives me fight. We're going to have to fall in love with place again and learn to stay put. Now, I put this over, I think we need both, right? But I thought Alan's, if you read Alan's talk this morning about here, that hope comes once we actually get to the tomb, but love is what gets us all the way through. And so I find myself with this right now. There are days when I don't have a lot of hope, but every day I wake up, I have a 3.5-year-old grandson. And I really love this little guy. So whether or not I feel hope that day, I'm going to fight for it. So, all right.
Thank you.